telling you, it's getting more like a great big fat old wedding cake that was caught too long out in the rain, and it's beginning to melt, and all the angels' wings are flapping down, and, you know, all the gauze and all the wonderful lace is beginning to drip, and it's kind of coming apart at the seams. Did you read what this guy said the other day? In fact, it was yesterday, I believe, across the river in Jersey. One of these doctors, you know, that's hung up on this socialized medicine bill, he came out with something that I have, it was one of the wildest statements I've heard, I'd say, since Teddy Roosevelt charged up San Juan Hill. Anyway, he was asked about the Hippocratic Oath, of which we all know, and he said, there is no question here of violation of an anachronistic oath taken to some false pagan gods. Do you realize what this is going to mean to TV medicine? Hey, are you? Come on, listen in here, guys. You're getting hung up on this. Listen to the conclusion here. You only got the first of the story. Do you realize what this means to TV medicine? Why, ever since I was a little kid knee-high to a thing, old Lionel Barrymore was looking over there talking to Dr. Kildare, and he was telling him about that Hippocratic Oath. And on the other hand, you know, this brings up some wild ideas, you know, about future medical programs that can be done along this line, you know? Because, as you know, there are 100 medical programs about to be done on TV with all kinds of wonderful guys. I could just... Here, I've got an ID for a show right now. Hello? Yes? Yes, this is Ben Casey, idealistic young TV Anglo-Saxon American doctor here in emergency, yes? What? Hello? Yoko, it's hung up, Ed. Yes, what? Hello? Yes? No, don't set it back. Now we got to start out all over again. Now, here, there we go. Hello? Yes, this is Ben Casey, idealistic young American Anglo-Saxon medical doctor here in emergency. What? You say hit by a truck at 4th and Main? How old was the man? 68. All right. Yes. You're bringing him in now. Yes. You say he's bleeding a quarter minute? Yes, yes. Does he have Blue Cross? What? Of course not. Look, you take that creeping socialist down to that old quack down on the corner, that old communist, what's his name, Barrymore. What did you say? Oath. Oh, look, that... Who? That Greek? Who's Hippocrates around here? What gods? Those are pagan gods. We don't believe in pagan... This is America here, son, and you're talking to an American doctor. And I am upholding American ideals in medicine. Yes. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Nurse Barker. Nurse Barker, would you please have this call transferred to old Dr. Barrymore down on the corner? Yes, the communist one. Yes, he treats all these creeping socialists. I'm sorry. You have called the wrong number this time. Yes, you're right. This is Ben Casey, idealistic young Anglo-Saxon American doctor in emergency. American medicine marches on with modern methods and modern ideals, following no false gods, honoring no anachronistic old-fashioned oaths. Ben Casey returns again next week at this same time on this same channel. I couldn't help... You know, when I first read this thing this morning, I thought it must be a misprint. It's interesting to note that the... doctor, by the way, it might be fascinating for you to look up a word that comes from the same Greek. The word is hypocrisy. And incidentally, it stems from the same attitude towards the oath. It's fascinating, you know. Can't you see a president, you know, being... all these oaths are old-fashioned. Do you know how old the oath is that the president takes? Our president? Using the same kind of thinking, our president could say, what is this old-fashioned, anachronistic oath that, for heaven's sakes, that was 200 years ago and more? These are modern days. What is this business? Don't come around to me with these old-fashioned, anachronistic oaths. Fascinating. All the way down the line, you know, in our society, there is really the cult. It's beginning to grow more and more and more. It's the kind of cult of no responsibility. It's a cult that says that my responsibility in this world is to make sure that nobody hangs responsibility on me, and that's plenty responsibility, let me tell you. And what is so fascinating is that this cult of irresponsibility that is creeping all over our world is doing so under the guise of responsibility. And so a senator will get up and say, we should be tough with Russia. We should march out there and really show them, because I am a responsible citizen. I am saying that. That's an interesting kind of responsibility. You can hear the sound of offstage drums booming. How is your responsibility going today? Are you holding up your end, old fellow citizen, are you? Yes. Are you keeping your end of the teeter-totter? Waited with the sheer courage of your convictions. In a sense, it's creeping Ayn Randism. Dollar sign cufflinks. Dollar sign hubcaps. And then there was a guy today in the Automobile League of America or somebody, someplace, somewhere, who got up maybe 24 hours ago, and he said, what is this socialistic idea of trying to give out a few bucks to the railroads for those commuters when everyone knows that a good American drives a car? A good American does not ride a railroad. Everyone knows that our way of life is symbolized by the Thunderbird. Obviously, this is a foreign ideology. I tell you this because I want to take on the responsibility of a good American. I stand four square. I say four square. I say four square, madam. What's good enough for General Motors is good enough for all of us. And you know, and often the irresponsibility also, interestingly enough, parades under the guise of sensitivity and excessive love. This can often be found in what, in a sense, is the Holden Caulfield trait in our society, which finds mostly its outward expression in literature of one kind or another. Yeah. I'll tell you, you know. Listen, I'll tell you, look, I know you don't want to hear about it, but I might as well start from the beginning with all the jazz, you know. Look, I'm just a kid, you know. And I'll tell you, there's one thing I hate. It's phonies, rotten phonies. Everywhere I see phonies, like my old man, for crying out loud, he gets himself a great big fat car, talks about how much gas he doesn't use. What a phony. No person that knows anything about it. My mother, my old lady, oh, what a phony. Smokes cigarettes, a long cigarette holder. Talks on the phone all day long at the bridge parties. Then she comes around and says, you love me, don't you, Holden? Don't you love me, Holden? What I say, yeah, I love her. What a phonus balloonus, no wonder I'm bugged. The only one who really understands is Phoebe. Oh, what a great chick, Phoebe. She's my 6-year-old sister, you know, and she listens to Bessie Smith records. I'll tell you, boy, she's great. Why, you don't know how great she is. And you know, one time I'm coming home from school, see, and Phoebe's walking along, and she kicks in this window, and I says, Phoebe, what'd you kick in the window for? She says, well, it was there, you know? That's how, she's great. You're a great chick, you know? She understands about this stuff, you know, and that's the trouble with my old man. You know, my old man always talks about love. He should know about love in a pig's ear. Love. What a fathead, love. You see, I'm telling you all this because, well, sometimes when I sit here and I look out over the fields and all that, and I wonder what, you know, everything is so wonderful and so great, and all the skies are so warm in the summertime, and people all they do is walk on and bug each other. You see, it's because, you know, sometimes I want to just take all the people, I want to hold them, and I say, I love you, you know? My old man, that fat head, he gets in his car, and he drives around, and he says, you know, I get 12 miles a gallon. 12 miles a gallon. The guy hasn't gotten over 5 miles a gallon on the downwind hill with the wind blowing after him. That phoniest blowness. My old lady sits there and talks about her. What a phony. See, it's love I'm talking about. They don't know nothing about love. It's rotten people. Oh, America, with your rotten billboards. Oh, America, with your gas-stenched highways. Oh, America. I love you. Hold it there. Oh, it takes many forms. Yeah, well, after all, Hippocrates was a Greek. And that's a foreign ideology, that Hippocratic Oath. Anyone knows these foreign ideas are often. You know, everyone knows about those foreign ideas. I could just, someday, you know, I could see some teacher getting up, you know, and making, talking about Socratic concepts and saying, well, you know, this is a Greek idea. Speaking of flight, what's the trouble? Sneezing in there? Well, that often happens when confronted with that sheer cliff. Speaking of sheer cliffs, this is WORAM and FM New York, and it's ineffable, and don't try to plunge through. Speaking of things, we have with us here tonight Kinney. And a lot of people rent cars during the summertime. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm beginning to come to the conclusion that owning a car is a pretty tough proposition. If it's in Manhattan, I'll tell you. I don't know whether you people out in the hinterlands know anything about owning a car here in New York City. Forget it. I mean, some people own a car only because it's like a conscience, and it keeps bugging them. And every morning they get up at 7 o'clock and they run out and fall down the stairs and try to change parking places. And it's a gigantic New York game, you see. In fact, I know one guy who hasn't used his car in over a year and a half because he's got the only parking place in Manhattan that is not marked. And he's afraid to give it up. He rented a car all last summer, kept his parking place. And if you're on the stick, you'll do the same thing. Kinney would like to talk to you about renting a car this summer. And they have a credit card thing that I think you'll find more than interesting to read. In fact, there's some genuine boffos in it. If you'd like to get one of these credit cards or at least find out about it, send your name and address to Kinney, K-I-N-N-E-E-Y-Y, Kinney, in care of Gene Shepherd, WOR, 1440 Broadway, New York, 18, New York. And you know that's me. And George. I'm getting Kinney's mail now. That's Kinney, in care of me, WOR, 1440 Broadway, New York, 18, New York. Now, it sounds like I'm being facetious, but actually I'm not. As a matter of fact, it is very difficult to own a car in New York. In fact, many guys find it's much more difficult to own a car than to keep married in New York. And that's pretty tough. And, in fact, many guys find that it's easier to buy a car and stick with the car, then, well, you know, it gets involved. Some guys have given up their wives and everything. I know one guy whose wife insisted on moving to Montclair, New Jersey. And this guy lived over on the east side, and it had taken him a year and a half to figure out the parking situation there, and he had it down pat. And he had this magnificent parking spot that nobody knew about, and he refused to move to New Jersey with his wife. She's living there now. He's living in his car. It's all right. He takes it off his income tax. It's a separate residence. See? I'm sorry. You know, I wish I could figure out some way where I could duck out of all the responsibilities of being here. And I guess in a way, you know, it's pretty It's pretty evident that all over the world today, people are attempting in some way or another to get out of their responsibilities. For example, if you listen, I do a great deal of listening to the Russian radio. I'm fascinated by Russian newscasts. Anything that happens in the world, but anything, is caused by the imperialistic Western warmongers. If they have a plague of locusts in the Ukraine, it is because the Western imperialist warmongers have chased all the locusts over the border. This is the truth. I'm not exaggerating at all. I'll never forget one day when a Russian team lost, some Russian soccer team lost, and I think they were playing Scotland or something. And they went on to say that in spite of the loss, it was amply demonstrated to the crowd that the beautiful team play and the esprit de corps and the genuine dedication of the Russian players was of much more importance than the individualistic, capitalistic goals that were scored by the Scottish team. I'm telling you, it's exactly like this. Now, if this isn't a nation hell-bent upon getting out of responsibility all over the world, I don't know of one. You'll find this is also evident in Castro. Of course, we try to do the same thing, too, in a lot of ways. But interestingly enough, America, particularly the literati, and particularly the hippies in America, have gone the other way, you see. They accept responsibility for everything in the world. Even the locusts in the Ukraine. He said, well, then there's something about it, you know. Something to it there. I remember one time I read about this farmer just across the border in the Ukraine, and he was beating the locusts with a fly swatter. And, you know, there's something to it, and we were putting them up to it. And it goes on and on like that. So I suppose, like in any office, you know, if you find one guy who has so many guilt complexes, for whatever reason they might be, Freudian or otherwise, that guy is going to, in the end, take the brunt, of everything that happens in the office, no matter whether, you know, he was even there or not. It's a fascinating phenomenon that you can see going on. Then, of course, in our private life, though, we do quite the opposite. We, nationally, as a people, feel, because the thing about being national about it is that it does not involve you. It's interesting that people will go for one particular ideology or another. It might be the Welch thing, it might be Goldwaterism, it might be anything else, all the way from the wide right-wing spectrum to the wide left-wing spectrum. But whatever it is, you see, it's an ideology that says those idiots have done it again. That's the beautiful thing about being, let's say, Goldwater. You can always say, they have done all these wrong things, and why don't we do this? But it's very different when suddenly you find yourself doing it. Like one of the beautiful quotes that are always used by these people, why always talk about defeat, they say, when what you should do is win. Well, win, of course, involves one of the most wonderful things, like being firm. Well, what does being firm mean? Marching around with soldiers? Getting out some guns and saying, all right, no more, and then start shooting them? Boy, that can be interesting. And I am not going the other way, so we're in a very interesting dilemma here. It's fascinating. And in our private lives, it's interesting to note, I think, probably the most significant thing in our private lives within the past 50 years has been the growth of I suppose you might say, it's not irresponsibility, it's non-responsibility, where it's the society that is always being put down. Where if an angry poet writes about anger, is he angry with himself? Is he angry for his inability to do things? Hardly ever. Oh no. It's society that's rotten. It's always the rotten. Oh, America, with your rotten gasoline-soaked highways. Oh, America, with your rotten billboards. Oh, society. Oh, rotten people. Oh, wonderful. Oh, sensitive me. And it's an interesting phenomenon. You know, it really is intriguing. Everywhere you go, you know, and I went to a little, I've gone to several of these things just because I'm intrigued by them. There are all kinds of little groups, big groups, in-between groups, and many, groups that don't even have shapes yet are forming. Forming an action group today is a major activity, whether it be for saving the radish beds in New Jersey, saving the push carts in the village, or making the world safe for kite flyers. Whatever it is, you know, it's a wonderful feeling, you know, to get together and to form a group. Well, the other day I saw this fascinating thing happen. somebody formed this group, you see, about the push carts. And boy, they were really teed off. They're going to save the push carts. The rumor had drifted down from somewhere in the park department or the city department or something that they were going to do it with push carts on Bleecker Street. Well, so they're having a big rally about the push carts. Well, in the middle of the rally, somebody called up from the city department and says, well, I'm all for the push carts. What's all the excitement about? And they felt real rotten. I could see all the wind was out of everybody's sails because the fight was over. There wasn't even a fight, really. All somebody had to do was call the city hall and say, come on about the push carts. And they just straightened it out. Just one little inspector probably said it, you know. One of these fascinating things. And the whole action group went out the window, and everybody sort of milled around, and the push carts were saved, and you could just see, oh, for crying out. Now what do we do? Not that the people weren't for the push carts. They were. But intriguingly enough, victory is, to people who believe in defeat as a way of life, is far less flavorful than they would have you believe. I know that, as a matter of fact, this is a... Of course, you have to form these things. You know, I think one of the reasons why that we are having trouble today with action groups was that in the 1930s, it was pretty easy to be for or against. There were two definite things. There was the American democratic way of life, period. And then there was another kind of thing called communism. And so there were a lot of guys, obviously, from what I read in the 30s, who were hung up on this. Well, then the war came, the purges came in Moscow in the 1930s, and the Hungarian thing, until finally it looks like everybody's a villain. And a lot of people are just unable to accept their society around them as being any good at all. And yet they look out and they can see that other societies have a lot of rotten things going, too. And so they can't really say, I'm for that. So in the end, they have to just be against what could be called the material things that are easy. They're just for peace, for example. That's a great thing to be for peace. Or they're against war. Well, that's a very easy, and who's for war, you know? It's as easy to be for peace as it is for motherhood, you know? And I say easier, because a lot of guys, frankly, are against motherhood. And in fact, they can earn great literary reputations by being against motherhood. So I would suspect that it's much easier to be against motherhood publicly than it is to be against peace. And so there's all kinds of these wild action. And I'm not against action groups, but I'm fascinated by the phenomena as to why. Are they really against or for the things that they're proclaiming they're against or for? Or are they merely... looking for some kind of action? I think people today are very restless. The machine has taken over a large function of our life. Entertainment has become canned. It is no longer a personal thing. There is comparatively little reading done today. And so finally, people are just, they've got the itch. And the only way the itch can find its way out is to be teed off, you know. You gotta get, because most people are not interested in what they're doing. They're not interested. Hardly anybody's interested in his work. In fact, I know people who do work that the average guy would think is wildly, just almost impossibly interesting. I mean, like TV production, like producing great big shows on television or writing movies. Do you know that I talked the other day to a guy who was a top movie writer, and he says, oh, I'm so bored, I'm bored out of my skull, you know. Here's a guy who travels from Greece to Rome, he spends 2 weeks in Rome, and then he goes to Greenland, he's so, boy, I'm really bugged. And so in the end, you find that hardly anybody really digs what he's doing. And I suspect that the only people who really do are the artists. And the artists like to assume that all the rest of the population does too, in one way or another, because they do. And so, in the end, if you don't really, really feel a great sense of exhilaration and drive and a real involvement with what you do, naturally life is boring. How many times can you watch Maverick? I mean, how many times can you fantasize over the Playgirl of the Month? How many times can you go to Jones Beach to try to run away from it? How many boats can you buy? How many Thunderbirds can you buy? How many times can you go around a golf course before you got to come back and then you sit down again? And so everybody, in a way, is trying to escape. Some people are trying to escape in a kind of mythical political ideology where all you have to do is to say we're going to do something and it's done. You have to decide it and then you do it. That's a myth. It's as much a myth as believe me, as Alice in Wonderland. If you know anything about that outside world that's out there, you know this. But nobody wants to be bothered with the truth. Not really. You know, this truth problem comes up in so many different ways. For example, I know a guy who wrote a review for a play. And he was writing, and I don't have any brief for the play, but I happen to have known a little bit about it. So he wrote this review about the play, and he blasted the producers personally for a certain thing that happened in the play that had to do with lighting and sound effects, because the play was dependent on lighting and sound effects, and he really blasted the producers for being careless, irresponsible producers, and so on and so on. And then he went out to rave over the girl who was in the play. Well, the truth of the matter was, unfortunately, the girl who was in the play was the reason why these producers could not do what they wanted to do with the lights and so on. It involved the union situation and everything else, and she would not give in. And so these poor guys were blasted for it. Well, I went to the reviewer and I said, you know, that wasn't very good. You know, you blasted these two guys, and they were the ones that were fighting to do it the way you wanted them to do it. And they're the only producers in New York that have really fought this lighting system and that in the last 10 years, and you blasted them. And he sort of grinned and says, oh, well, yeah, what are you going to do about it? I says, what do you mean, what are you going to do about it? Now these guys are trying to raise money for another show, and they can't get the dough because of your review. It makes them sound like irresponsible people. He says, well, yeah, that's the way it is. The implication, don't bother me with the truth. Truth is always getting in the way of what I write. Just like Joe McCarthy is, you know, whenever you bring up the proof you weren't a communist, don't give me that stuff. I don't want that truth. Facts are always very difficult to deal with in life. And so in our own life, you know, we've come kind of around full circle now where the man, the person today, hardly anyone, as I say, is really interested in his life. You know, we talk about automation as being such a great thing. But then what are you going to become interested in, you know? You know, the idea always being that when people get a great deal of leisure time, they're going to spend their time doing all those wonderful things that they didn't have time to do before. Whereas, as a matter of fact, they've always had plenty of time to do them. Now, anybody working an eight-hour day for 5 days a week has got plenty of time to read, go to the beach, fish. Really has, you know. Really, as much as he wants to, anyway, without going out of his skull and getting tired of it. That's the truth, you know. You fish 6 days a week for one solid month, and you've had it up to here. Believe me, I know. You read a book at morning, noon, and night for one solid week, and you want to run. I'm telling you, you want to get the feel of something in your hand, a saw or something pounding. You want to get something. You go out of your skull. How long can you live vicariously? After you've driven your Chris Craft in a circle for 14 years, you've had it up to here. And you know what I'm talking about, what you've had up to here. I mean, you can get just so hung up on golf, and then what? And so in the end, automation, you see, is one of the most interesting. And automation is taking place in different ways, you know, so you go to work. Automation is also, by the way, automatic polling, one thing and another. You know, it has many ramifications, this automation business. And it gets to the point, you know, where many people are just going out of their mind, honestly, just trying to find something they're interested in. Well, everybody's interested in anger. And so you can start yourself an anger group anytime you want. Because anger, do you know that one of the most, psychologically, one of the most exciting of all emotions is anger? It's even more exciting by far than love. Love is often a very passive emotion. And in fact, is often an emotion that you don't even know you've got. But anger, you know, and it's very exciting. Many people are looking for something to get angry about because it's the only time of the day that they're interested. They're excited, you know, it's very exciting. And I'm not telling you that there aren't many things you should be angry about. There are. But I wonder whether the people really are angry about those things, or whether they're just enjoying the anger, you know? I'm curious about that. Just intrigued, that's all. You know, speaking of that, the other day, and people, of course, are always saying wonderful things about what the man on the street is going to do when he gets all this leisure time. He's going to have all this time, and he's going to start reading, and he's going to go to plays, and he's going to do all these wonderful things. All these great things are going to happen. And whereas, as a matter of fact, you'll find that in most colleges today, the education itself is away from that. Most of the education today is of a very functional nature. A great deal of it. The liberal arts colleges in most universities are shrinking to practically nothing. In fact, I know one guy out in the Midwest at a big university out there who, when I first got to know him, was one of the big wheels in the archaeological department of this university. And it was connected with the humanities, of course, and he was a big wheel on the campus, within the faculty, because his department was very important, paleontology, archaeology, and it was a classical study. This is a classical study of intense interest to people who are really interested in the world around them. And yet this department has shrunk now today till it really looks like the appendix of a small-sized mouse. It is a vestigial organ in a disappearing creature. And yet, on the other hand, the business administration school has burgeoned. The business administration school and other schools of that kind. And so when these people get out into business, providing they do make the grade into the technical automated world, so what else do they care about? You know, you can get hung up on a 707 computer just so long, and you can get involved in the cost price structure, and that'll hold you, sustain you for a while, but only if it's a little tiny business of your own. When you're involved in a gigantic organization, you couldn't care less, you know? People really are not worried about whether or not they're making it when they're working in an enormous organization. And I have worked in enormous organizations because it's so impersonal, you know. Who cares, really? So in the end, your only real care is whether you're going to keep your job. That's all. You're not actually worried about the work. I'd like to know how many guys around here are really worried about putting on good radio programs or good television shows. And I'm not just saying WOR. I'm talking about all big organizations of this kind. And they're more concerned with keeping their job. And that is really often confused for dedication. It's really not the same thing. Because it isn't possible for them to be. Because most people are not even connected with it. You go to the automobile place where they make cars. And making an automobile today is such a fantastically impersonal thing that they might as well be canning sardines. As a matter of fact, it might be even more interesting to can a few sardines. I mean, at least they're fish, you know. And they're alive, you know, you can see the tails and stuff there. But after you've turned out 87 billion Hoopmobile 7s, it doesn't mean anything. They all look the same, and they stamp them out until finally some guy in that gigantic line, you know, all he was worrying about is whether his vacation's going to come around or not. That's about it. Whether he's going to last till he can get his fringe benefits. The fringe benefits, incidentally, in many places today assure you an honest, reliable, and a very, very dignified burial. Are you aware of that? This is the fringe benefit of many a corporation. And some of these guys, some of these people around, are asking now for about a four-hour day. I wonder what they want. What do they want it for? I would hate a four-hour day. I'm serious. I just wonder what people want this four-hour day for. Well, it's because they don't like what they're doing. That's all. Gets down to that. They want to get away from it. Then the question is, what do they do when they get away from it? Well, they sit and argue. You know? And most guys say, well, I'll get another job. Oh, in a pig's ear. Not when automation gets going, buddy. Other job, you'd be lucky to have the one you got, you know, the four-hour day one. I heard one guy say that the strain of the 52-hour year is beginning to show on Charlie. Well, you know, it's true. So what this all boils down to is that nobody wants any responsibility, because what is a job but responsibility? A job is a place where you are needed to do something, and you don't want it. You want to stay home. You don't even want to do that, so you get a boat. Because if you stay home, you're liable to have a few responsibilities there, too, like kids crying in the kitchen, that kind of jazz. So what you do then is to get somebody to come in and sit with the kids, and then you go out with the boat. Now, the boat is the ideal solution to the problem. And have you noticed that most boats today look like cars? That gives people a sense of a nice sense of identification. They don't, you know, that boat could easily be a boat, you know. So if you put fins on it and you put a great big Plymouth steering wheel, they have it, you know. They have a dashboard that looks exactly like a Chevy Corvair on the new boats. And they even have automobile-type motors in them. So you know, you don't want... Because I do believe that that today the average man feels far more a genuine sense of real and true identification and security when he's in his car than when he's anywhere else. Primarily because he's moving. And when you're moving, they can't catch up with you. When you're moving, there can be no responsibility at all. None whatsoever. That's the whole idea of moving. Because as soon as you start being stationary, then there's little things happen. Vines grow, you know, and somebody's got to water the geraniums. And someone has to, you know, there's all those little things going on, you know, like faucets squeaking and all that. And just general, you know. So you get in the car and you go, and the wind flies. And then you jump in the boat, you go for a while. Then you run around the golf course. The golf course, I suspect, is the true summation of man's frustration today. No wonder that there's a great upsurge of golf. You see, this is a non-responsibility in a way. It's a very emotionally involving non-responsibility, non-contest, and in a sense, you see, because if you play other people, then it becomes very embarrassing. So golfers always say, "I'm playing myself," because if you play other people, you're liable to lose, and nobody wants to lose in this world. Again, of non-responsibility, because losing involves responsibility, you know. So you're playing against a par, and you're playing against all these abstractions, but they're not real people. And the concept again of win and loss is involved in again the problem of responsibility. We're not looking for it. No, and don't say this is an American problem. Let me tell you, you should spend 20 minutes listening to the Russian newscast. You would be fascinated at the tremendous amount of ducking out of responsibility that goes on those newscasts. We could never do it, even with a clear conscience, but it's coming to that. Individually, we can. Collectively, we can. Interestingly enough. We have one set of morals which we use collectively, and we have another set which we use privately. And, of course, the morals are things that sneak up on you. Anyway, oh, and you know, speaking of there's a current belief that culture is growing. And they will quote you how many paper books were sold. I'm wondering how many paper books are read. I'm really curious about that. I wonder, out of the number of paper books that are sold, let's say in the average paper book store a month, and there are thousands, I'm curious about how many of those are actually read and finished. I'd like to know how many people have got their bookcases loaded with paper books they bought waiting for a bus one day. Every time they go to the paper book gallery, they buy a couple of things by Descartes and Spinoza, and they go through the Kierkegaard bit, and they buy the thing by Kafka, they buy the castle or something, and they read about three pages, and that's really great. And they carry it around a couple of days, and they pick it up again. The next thing you know, it's in the old bookshelf there, and now they got 490 of them. You see, and the point is that they have become a statistic. 490 very classical, high class, very important paper books were sold to this guy. Well, were they read? You know, that's a good question. And so we have these false statistics which prove things which are not provable. Really not provable. And then if he does read it, does he get anything out of it? Is his education been so that he can read Kafka sideways, backwards, upwards, and down, and hold it up to the light and still not understand it? The average guy gets this thing by Spinoza, and he finally reaches the end, and it's all literally Greek to him, but he's read it. I've known people who do that. They'll read. It's the classic remark, you know, of I think it was in a play, wasn't it? Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, where all these people were sitting around talking about the Moby Dick, and she says, "Well, I've read that book. That's about a whale." Well, this says it all. You see, it is about a whale. Well, here's this great little news note from London that in a sense, says very much about this thing about culture and where they're going to go when they get all this time. Shakespeare is poison at the box office, says American director John Ainsworth, who is about to make a movie of Othello. I want you to hear this. This is a great article. You know Othello. All right, listen to this. This is, what a beautiful article. This is being filed in my immense trivia file, to be saved for future generations. When they dig up in the rubble, they'll know how it is. This is from London. Shakespeare is poison at the box office, says American director John Ainsworth, who is about to make a movie of Othello. So he's going to call the million-dollar picture The Moor of Venice. It's a great shame, said Ainsworth, but it would be sudden death to call the film Othello. The credits will show that the screenplay is by Ainsworth, Not until the movie is over will the customers be told that it is based on a play by William Shakespeare. It's going to be different from other productions in that we're casting Othello as a young, handsome man, and Iago as an old, embittered man of about 60. He said, "This film is also going to be different because we're introducing love scenes between Othello and Desdemona. No dialogue, of course, because no love scenes are written in the play." What a fascinating play they're producing here. It should be very sexy. That's his comment. The movie will be made in Ireland, of all places. British actor Lawrence Harvey will play Othello. He's a Moor. Ainsworth said, "One of Britain's theatrical greats will play Iago, but he wouldn't say which one." "We thought first of having Gene Simmons for Desdemona," said the director, "but we decided she was a little old. Now I'm looking for a girl about 19, perhaps to 21. It should be very sexy." And so this will become another great statistic. This will become another statistic. Over 2.5 million people last month alone went to see a movie based on Othello. I'm looking forward to the 10-minute week. And I've got a great idea for a job that I'd like to do for that 10-minute week. Great idea. I've got all kinds of plans. I'm thinking of buying myself a lot of notebooks. Oh, but then again, on the other hand, I don't suppose it matters one way or the other, you know. I suspect that Hippocratic Oath is anachronistic. I mean, it's no doubt about it. Those are pagan gods. And what's this guy, Hippocrates? What's his name? Hippocrates? You know, they named the hippopotamus after Hippocrates. Do you know that? That's also the same parallel. See, those Greeks. What are you going to do about that crowd? You know, they got their hands in everything, always moving, always working. Then pagan gods all over the place. Well, I don't blame you, Doc. All right, George.